Hello, Sunlit Ones. My name is Tyler.
And my name is Brooke.
And this is Cosmere Conversations. We are so glad to be back here in the new year, wrapping up the final episode of the Sunlit Man Book Club. It's been a journey. The Year of Sanderson has taken us into the next, and we're putting together all of the Cosmere connections that we possibly can in this last final episode, incorporating all your thoughts from all the different book clubs, the things we've learned from Brandon, spoiler streams, all that good stuff, putting it into one last final hoorah.
I don't know if we'll fully get to every single detail, but we're going to do our darndest because this book is just chock full of references to the larger Cosmere with guest appearances by people from Scadrial and people from the Night Brigade coming in for the first time. So lots of exciting things to talk about. And I would love to just start with some of the smaller details that indicate the state of the Cosmere at the time of the Sunlit Man.
Yeah, give us some perspective and some understanding of the context when the story takes place. But we are going to be looking at the big picture here more than following the specific plot details.
There is a Silverlight guidebook that has been left on Canticle by a Thalen. This is so interesting to me. This description of the Silverlight guidebook sounds a lot to me like the real world Arcanum Unbounded. It's described as, quote, an antiquated volume, the type originally written through much travail by people visiting the various planets on difficult expeditions. This old volume was a survey book, which spoke of many different planets, a little on each one, end quote.
Certainly sounds like the work of Chris and Nas going on difficult expeditions, having travails, and then putting that all together in, at the time, what we didn't, you know, understand as a guidebook. But I really think that that's the best call that we have right now. You know, some published version of Chris's notes, maybe far in the future with some addendums and some, you know, more knowledge given and perspective given. But this is kind of like the sports almanac from Back to the Future 2, where it's a book that sets up some of the plot, because like getting this book into the hands of the Cinder King is essential for changing his mindset.
Yes, it is the sort of key to unlock his knowledge and interest of the greater Cosmere. Obviously, we can't trust a lot of what the Cinder King says. Mm-hmm. So who knows, like, what happened with this Thalen person, etc. But it's certainly important to the development of the Cinder King. And then I think it becomes somewhat significant to Nomad as well. Another reference to this kind of greater world of the Cosmere and also the importance of Silverlight. We've got this Silverlight guidebook and then another fact kind of backing up the importance of Silverlight in the future of the Cosmere is Nomad's reference to, quote, the Refugee and Lost Expatriate Bill of Silverlight, Codes of Interplanetary Conduct. End quote. And this code enables him to formally request asylum.
Yes, from the Scadrians right. In their little base on Canticle. And this is a little bit of speaking the lingo or connecting with the people that are your audience at the time. It is his assumption that these Scadrians are abiding by the codes and certainly right. Are not just going to ignore this formal request when done in this way, which to me points to, I hope, the long felt influence of someone like Steris and Marasi, or Marasi, as some of you would like me to say. But those two may have set the groundwork for this kind of, you know, legalese, but also like an official code. That sounds right up their alley of the mindset that would be important and maybe built on, like a foundation for Skadrian society to be built on, if they're establishing codes in their time in regards to trade with the Malwish, or, you know, expanding their society outward, they're building their legal system with Marassi into a more kind of formal and putting the law above the, you know, rule of nobles or the rule of a royalty or a monarchy. All of that stuff is probably influencing for the long term, in the same way like the founding fathers in America are still talked about. And you may even phrase something today if you want to like call upon the founders. I feel like, I hope at least, that some of this formal language coming out of the Skadrians, who are now a spacefaring and very technologically advanced society, is connected back to the influence of those women in the past.
I admire your confidence in Steris and Marassi, but I don't think that this comes from them at all. They're called the Silverlight Codes of Interplanetary Conduct. And so to me, this is definitely coming like down from the top, from Silverlight, from Chris and her scholars in Silverlight as they have been traveling throughout the Cosmere. The planets that they go to have maybe adopted those codes and agreed to abide by them, but I do not think that Skadriel created these codes.
Yeah, I think at the time of Chris, or the time long before the Sunlit Man, I think that Silverlight feels a lot more loosey-goosey with their approach to things. And not so formal.
Yeah, and they're a
formal.
Little bit more, like, hidden.
Yes,
I think
definitely.
They're kind of trying not to make contact. And so the existence of these codes and their universal acceptance and adoption indicates that the people of Silverlight have stopped hiding, have at some point come out and said, hey, everyone, we're Silverlight now that we all, like, know each other. Because I'm assuming from the end of Stormlight 5, there are many more people coming into the cognitive realm, traveling mm-hmm. through the cognitive realm, which we've also seen in other series start to happen much more frequently. Therefore, they're going to come upon Silverlight, discover Silverlight, discover the other planets, blah, 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 globalization, but in this case, universalization. And the codes became needed. Like, there was no more need for hiding and subterfuge. There was need for structure and agreement.
Yeah, I think that happened. And in at least in my imagination, the main group that could be responsible for that formal structure are the Skadrians, because they seemingly are the most advanced in the Cosmere, or one of the most advanced in the Cosmere. And so they would be the ones. And there, I at least totally get what you're coming from. They can be 100% separate.
Yeah. It just, like, if anything, maybe the Azish helped, but I think it's probably coming mostly from Silverlight, that has more knowledge of all the planets. And especially with, as we're going to get to in a minute, the attitude of the Skadrians now, in the present of the Sunlit Man, they don't seem like they're real about the codes, you know? Like, they seem like they probably agreed to it because they couldn't not, but I don't know that they would have really been like gung-ho and participating in their creation.
That's an excellent point. One of the other main things that's established in The Sunlit Man is the classification and the description of breath equivalent units.
Yes, huge addition here.
And so detailed for the nerdy among you. Yes, I have created new spreadsheets just to help us understand breath equivalent units and what they apply to across the Cosmere. And kind of, we'll just continually add to that so that there's just a master list of how much BEUs do things cost in the Cosmere. Why don't you start us out with just kind of like the basic breakdown? Because normally what's happening is Ox is giving a description as a percentage of skip capacity. Skipping for Nomad takes 100% of his capacity. And then what we hear throughout the story are variations of that. So, like, kind of fill us in with what we learn.
Well, at 5% skip capacity, Nomad has 1,000 BEUs, 1,000 breath equivalent units. And at 5% skip capacity, he is more powerful and more endurant. This amount, 5% skip capacity or 1,000 BEUs, is equivalent to the fourth heightening on Nalthus, which gives one perfect life sense.
Interesting, and I think really important going forward, especially with what we saw on Kamashi as well with Awakened Machines, is that Nightblood was created with 1,000 breaths. That is the amount that Chishara, who was of the ninth heightening, significantly higher, but she put 1,000 breaths into the sword and that awakened it. And I found it interesting that fourth heightening or life sense was the thing that awakened Nightblood. It was right. Having an awareness of
life sense gives life.
Yes, kind of almost like purpose.
Minimum amount needed for
consciousness
life.
Or some type of consciousness. Now, I don't necessarily think that Nightblood has stayed at 1,000 breaths, because I think there's a question of like, can he be absorbing, like he absorbs breaths or absorbs investiture, and then he expels smoke, which can be some investiture loss. But I also assume that he can just keep a whole bunch of that inside of himself.
Yeah, I guess I don't know if we know that he frequently stores investiture, or is it all kind of immediately, quote unquote, metabolized in whatever processes Nightblood uses?
I don't think we know for sure. Let us know what your thoughts are. I'm kind of the opinion that, and maybe this is true of the Father Machine as well, that Nightblood maybe started with awareness, life sense, and 1,000 breaths, but then to get him up to, you know, where he is today, a little bit more of a conscious being, he could take like another 1,000, another 10,000, and maybe if we reassessed how much BEUs Nightblood had at any given time, he would comfortably be carrying around an 8,000 or a 10,000 amount of breaths.
I don't know. I do know that there's a word of Brandon about the amount of investiture that Nightblood can hold and it being not infinite. Mm-hmm. Like there is a cap. I don't know if we have any words of Brandon about the effect of that. Does it make him more sentient or not? Does it give him additional powers or not? Like, I don't know if it would have the same effect on a sword that it does on a human.
Yeah.
To take in more investiture, like, does it have any effect, or is it basically like putting breaths into a coat where it just is a receptacle that holds them, but they're not doing anything other than potentially powering Nightblood's processes?
Yeah, let's go through a couple of the other things that we hear from the Sunlit Man, and then maybe we can revisit the question of Nightblood as we learn more.
We hear that 1,500 BEUs is less than 8% skip capacity, which would put someone over the fourth heightening. Over 2,000 BEUs enables capital C connection manipulation. This is when Nomad is able to speak the language of the Canticleites. And that's equivalent to the fifth heightening, which gives one agelessness.
So enabling connection, agelessness, and according to Ox, the 10% or 2,000 BEUs level is where normal healing begins to break down for Nomad. Anything below 10% and he's not able to heal at full capacity. We really don't understand or have a good understanding of what normal healing is for a former Dawn Shard holder at this high level, you know, advanced Cosmere. So he might be normally healing like a fifth ideal Knight Radiant, which is an insane amount of healing, or normal healing might be considered something closer to 1,000 or 10,000 breaths, like a little bit of healing, but maybe not like a Renarin level healing or anything to the extreme or maximum.
This whole system also gives us a little bit of context to, again, the wider world. Nomad says, quote, "On Nalthus, they bought, sold, and traded chunks of people's souls like they were gemstones. BEUs as a measurement were based on this system, though at least there, the transaction left you alive. End quote. And that's a reference to, of course, the Sun Hearts on Canticle, where you must die to transfer your investiture.
Yeah, and the breaths on Nalthus, we learn also that, quote, even on highly invested worlds, a person's soul isn't more than 3 BEUs, end quote. We would assume that Nalthus is one of those worlds where the breath is adding to the soul of a person. And we've talked a lot about, like, what is a drab versus a regular Cosmerian versus someone from Nalthus with a breath. But even giving a Nalthinian or whoever is the most invested soul in the Cosmere, we're talking about 3 total BEUs.
Right. And I would say, at least from what we hear in The Sunlit Man, the Threnodites are the people that I've heard talked about most often as being highly invested or having extra investiture attached to their soul. I think we talked a little bit about perhaps Nalthians, if you were to vaporize them on Canticle and put them in a Sun Heart, they might have a tiny bit extra investiture where it would be more powerful, for example, than the Rosharan Sun Heart. But I don't know if it would be as powerful as the Threnodites Sun Hearts.
Yeah, this is an interesting question because I have seen elsewhere, not directly from the text, this is just people talking online, and so I don't want to give full strength to this, but I think Threnodites only have 1 to maybe like 1.5 BEUs, and it's not exactly the BEUs that are special for the Threnodites.
Right.
It's some Threnodite thing. It's some extra bit that makes the magic system and eventually the Sun Hearts possible. Because, to put in context, 1 Sun Heart is 200 BEUs, or about 1% of Nomad's skip capacity.
Mm-hmm.
This figure and this difference, let's just say that Threnodites have 1 BEU souls, but that 1 BEU soul, when on Canticle, is turned into a Sun Heart with 200 BEUs of energy potential.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is the magic. It's telling me that whatever's happening on Canticle between the Threnodites, between their souls and the...
and the sun.
The sun that it is connecting to the core, that like electrical spark with the Threnodites in the middle, that's a 200x multiplier. Maybe a little bit less than 200x, but you get me. It's basically a 200x multiplier. And the big question would be, can that be applied to something other than a Threnodite soul and get 200x? Can you have a grand apparatus that is able to take in any form of investiture, maybe like a coat with 1,000 breaths in it, and give you a 200x output by running it through some process?
I'm curious if it's like maybe the connection that they have to the planet or to each other.
And I think there's something about resistance and operating, maybe kind of like in a network situation where if they are connected to each other,
right,
but it is one soul that's being transformed into 200 BEUs in a Sun Heart. Maybe it is some type of like the power is pinged through the whole community, and that's, you know, generating more than would be expected or something along those lines.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see, like, maybe this is a good question for Brandon. Would there be a difference in Sun Heart power if Nomad was vaporized on Canticle at the beginning of the book versus the end of the book?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. Because you're talking about the connection to the planet being the thing that changed.
Yeah.
That's a good call out. And if anybody, you know, has the moment to ask Brandon a question.
There's a question if
there
you need one.
There is a very good one. I think worth mentioning is that 20,000 BEUs is 100% skip capacity. That's the 9th heightening, which Shashara had. And it is the amount that Nomad was able to absorb, and maybe even more, from the Cinder King at the end of the book. He goes from near zero to 100% skip capacity by taking out everything from the Cinder King. So the Cinder King was at the ninth heightening.
Wow. And that gives a person greater awakening.
Yeah, which is
the property.
Which I think is what Shashara used.
Yeah.
And the knowledge that she has. And lastly, we know another number from Warbreaker is 50,000. 50,000 breaths is the 10th heightening and what the God King famously was holding. That's 250% of skip capacity.
Ooh.
So you can get 2.5 skips. And remember, Nomad has been skipping multiple times around the Cosmere, visiting more planets maybe than Hoyt has ever been to. So he's burning through a bunch of BEUs every
Hopefully
time he skips.
They're not all like people's souls.
Yeah,
Hopefully it's, you know, mostly a Stormlight or something that's not from humans.
It's a great question of where is he getting this investiture? Because this is not a small amount. And if he needs 100% in order to skip, and it's, you know, from 100 to near zero every time, that's a rough transition.
Yeah.
And a lot of investiture that you have to be channeling or in possession of to make that happen.
Let's move on to our good old friends, the Skadrians, and talk about what we learn from these very strange, new, futuristic Skadrians that we get. The first kind of indication of the Skadrians that we see is the authorization key, which is a metal disc described as being about as wide as a person's palm. And there is a symbol on the front, you know, probably a metal alphabet symbol. My question is this the same thing as a medallion, or is it some different type of technology? What do you think?
I think that with the authorization key and the way that medallions are known to work, this makes a lot of sense as just a medallion. A medallion kind of famously needs the connection bit of metal in the center and then variant type of metal outside. But if you were going to have an authorization key, the main thing you would want is like a connection-based pass. And then you just are able to scan someone's connection to allow them entry. And if they don't have the connection, then they shouldn't get entry. So to me, yeah, it sounds exactly like the advanced form of what we saw as the medallions in the past.
Right. Yeah. And then we also hear that, quote, plastic key cards were, of course, eschewed by them. They had a fetish for metal, end quote, which just tells us that the Cosmere has plastic now.
Yes.
Fun fact.
Plastic's a big deal in our own society. I'm wondering if they come from the same source, which is mainly like a lot of oil production in our own
interesting.
World.
Interesting. Yeah, sure.
And so they would also have oil if they have plastics and got them in the same way. But we are also discovering new ways of building similar things to the plastics we have and like finding different development methods. And they have magic. So I'm going to guess that they might have a different route of developing those plastics. But I can just, you know,
I just can't wait to see some Skadrian people with, you know, their leftovers and Tupperware.
Yeah, I was thinking like little toys and stuff because of, you know, Hoid's shirt, famous, like the Hawaiian Merwill shirt.
Yeah.
I'm seeing that being sold next to like some travel trinkets
that
are, you know, designed to resemble old healer. Maybe you have the gunslinger and it's just like waxes old weapons or something, but designed as little plastic toys.
Yeah, like an army guy, but it's wax instead.
100% Wayne with his sticks.
Okay, and then when we finally meet the Skadrians, they're wearing jeans and lab coats. We have our first instance of denim jean pants, which is weird.
It's a little weird. We had dusters, which is, you know, right on the precipice of getting to jeans.
That's very different from jeans.
It's a very different stylistically, and we in the United States associate post-World War II with the jeans, but originally a duster and jeans were developed for the same type of people, which is like working outside and need something really resistant to the elements and tears and stuff.
Yeah, but we're even way past that. These are lab technicians just
That's what
wearing
I'm saying.
Jeans casually.
They've advanced just as we have beyond
way past.
And now jeans are stylistically, you know, just your comfort wear as many people have them here.
Yeah. Wild. And when we come into their little research spaceship that they've been camping out in, we find out that they have sort of kidnapped some Threnodites, Canticleites, as research subjects. And they've also been trading with the Cinder King for Sun Hearts. In exchange, they give him pieces of technology and knowledge, and they state really clearly that this has been strategized out, and they are withholding some technology from the population, for example, ship-to-ship guns from those local people. And they say, quote, "Why would we reveal such a useful secret?" end quote. Even when the people of Beacon are fighting for their lives.
Yeah, this is a tough one. I don't really like the Skadrians doing this. I don't really like when countries in our modern world do this, or in the past did this. It's not great, and it certainly is a vibe, but there are many arguments that people would use today, or did use in the past, why this is perfectly acceptable to do this to other humans, let alone people on different planets. It may become the norm if we, you know, ever developed into a far advancing space faring people, that we also have similar rules. But I would prefer a don't get involved at all policy, or certainly not a we'll hold them back from certain types of destruction because we are more comfortable with these other types of destruction.
Like, who are you to decide, right? Just coming in here acting like God, being like, oh, we'll give you this, but not that. You can have this, but you can't have that.
Yeah.
No.
I don't like people.
Bad move.
Too much power, and they're abusing the Canticleites.
Yeah.
And they are gaining, you know, knowledge or whatever they want from the Sun Hearts by empowering a dictator and a tyrant. And they know that they're doing that.
Yeah, they know everything. They know all of the bad things that are the consequences of their actions, and they just don't care. One interesting thing about the interaction that the Skadrians have with Nomad is the first thing that they ask him is, have you said the oaths? And he lies a little bit. He kind of avoids the question by saying, I'm a free man.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an interesting way to frame the Night Radiant Nahel bond that we haven't seen before, as the opposite of being oathed as being free, right? That kind of indicates that if you are oathed, you are bound, maybe in a negative connotation. So I thought that was really interesting. And then they also assume that because he has a shard blade, he's done mercenary work. They're kind of like, oh, you must be a mercenary if you've got that blade. What does that say to us about the state of the Knights Radiant currently and kind of their reputation in the greater Cosmere?
I think it gives us a lot of questions, but the distinction is obvious and the Skadrians know it. They know that there's a difference between a Spren blade being oath-bound and a shard blade wielder. And that is their distinction in their mind. One is kind of okay as a mercenary, and one is more problematic.
We don't really know. Yeah, they seem to not be into it.
Exactly. Like, they didn't want to cross paths. And that is reiterated in the preview for Six of the Dusk, where we have a Rosharian and a Skadrian arriving on First of the Sun. And so conflict, I imagine, between those who are oathbound and the Skadrians, who maybe consider themselves freedom spreaders, or like spreading unbound protection or unbound technology, something along those lines. Maybe that's how they rationalize some of their behavior. In contrast to the Rosharians, who are, my question is still, when are the Rosharians able to get off of Roshar?
Yeah.
And is it possible that the first people who were able to get off were those with shard blades? And shard blades are so valuable and deadly that they became Cosmere mercenaries and were maybe exposed to like the wider Cosmere first. And then you would have this second group that shows up wielding their Spren blades at some time. But we know they can't get off right now. And so that's kind of my distinction that I'm seeing.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of questions that we don't really have the ability to speculate about currently, but maybe we'll have some more clues to that at the end of Stormlight 5.
Were these groups of Skadrians called the Time Tellers?
Yeah. So this is a new name or grouping of Skadrians that we've heard. It's said to be, quote, one faction among the many Skadrian political movements, end quote.
And theoretically, they're neutral in current conflicts. They're a group of scientists and are seeking to understand the various mysteries of the Cosmere. But they're kind of involved in this conflict. I don't know if this is what they consider neutral, but it's not neutral.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds like they are in propaganda. They sure. are neutral, yeah, yeah. Like that's their public persona. But Nomad says, quote, and they were absolutely not, of course, an arm of the military working in secret to develop tech that would let Skadriel stay ahead in the increasingly dangerous arms race that currently consumed most of the developed planets, end quote.
This is a big question. And of course, taking our own world as the historical example, you know, what happened when nations across the world were able to start running into each other and arms races or tech races to advance were very common. And the source of a lot of wars and conflict was we need to continue to advance our society. We need to build up the industry so that we are capable of competing against pick whatever empire you want right. at whatever time.
Yeah.
And that, you know, can create a lot of bad things, both internally within a country, if you're being motivated by an outside force, but also if those forces ever come to clash, it is, you know, quote, a fight of civilizations because you are seemingly going up against your mortal enemy. And I think that if you had a wave, and we will, fingers crossed, say it's not a Dalinar-led wave, an Odium-led wave off of Roshar, but imagine a bunch of Odium-led mercenaries with shard blades pushed out and led by Dalinar after Stormlight 5. That's the first interaction that Skadriel and every major planet has with the wider Cosmere. It could throw them into a negative mindset forever. And then they're just in the arms race because they see like this first bad wave that comes out and they're like, oh no, we're afraid. And so from that moment on, it is a constant struggle.
I mean, I think we already see this starting in the second era of Mistborn and the Elendil Basin being, you know, having thought that they were the only people yep. on Skadriel for a long time. They are very xenophobic. They're not into the Malwish. And as soon as they discover the Malwish and discover that the Malwish have knowledge and technology that is different from the Elendilians, they immediately are already defensive and competitive
exactly.
with the Malwish. I don't think that attitude changes at all. It just gets expanded to include, you know, now not only did we find out we're not the only people on our planet, we're not even the only people in our galaxy. There's all of these other people who have different technology, different knowledge than us. And I think that we're seeing that there's a real resistance to that from the Skadrians' part. And I think as you were describing about our world, as history moves forward, we start to see the lines blur between science and military. And this faction, these time tellers, are kind of able to say, hey, 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 like we're not warlike. We're not part of the military. We're just here to learn things, to advance our civilization. We're doing science. This is not about competition or aggression, when really those things become completely enmeshed together, where you cannot separate your military advances and your competition with others from your scientific advancement.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Oppenheimer being the big movie that came out exploring this is a bunch of scientists.
Like, this is just science, man. Isn't this interesting? We're learning about our world. Can you believe it?
And I think for some people, that's the propaganda that worked, and that is the hook that was used to bring them in,
yeah,
and maybe allowed them to overlook
right.
the murder of many hundreds of thousands of Japanese people. But for other people, the pitch was, we are going to build a weapon that will make us safe. We are going right. to prevent our troops from storming yeah. beaches or needing to use conventional military methods. And right. we're just going to have long range missiles.
Both
and it's
like protection, selling protection yes. and selling superiority.
Yeah.
Right. Like, not only will this make us better than those other people who are other and we don't like them, but it's going to keep us good people in our tribe safe.
Yeah. And seeing that on display, the microcosm, what you described in the Ellendale Basin, and in this book, the kind of macro picture of what that turns into when it's applied to the entire Cosmere, we're in for a rough bit. Like, this yeah. is not going to be great, I think. And it's such an interesting way of exploring these concepts, because I think it's easier for people to distance themselves in certain situations. If you write a story that is really about the modern political arguments going on in your
sure,
country,
yeah.
but you put it into a different time period, or you put it into a different yeah. planet, it allows people to kind of like get
it
in and understand
it. Some distance, some remove from something that we may feel really attached to, so that we can actually look at it from a more clear standpoint. And I'm a little bit excited for that as the Cosmere continues to move forward, to kind of go on this journey where we start from very hero's journey-esque type stories, mm-hmm. you know, of Vin going on a heist and these broad archetypes that exist in a lot of stories that have been passed around for generations, and for it to move into a much more complex sci-fi world where you've got lots of complexity in the interactions between many different types of people on their own planet, on different planets, and politics, and the ability to kind of assess all of these things, as you said, with a remove through these stories is pretty exciting.
It's certainly exciting. I'm looking forward to it. I'm imagining some dark times,
yeah.
but I am also imagining a field that is dense with story potential. You can tell every possible story in the most complex way. It's not just a simple adventure story, your basic hero's journey. This is legitimately whatever story wants to be told can be told, and we get to watch that be played out in part with space travel.
Yeah,
let's talk
of course,
more space.
Speaking of science, the Skadrians have a spaceship. This is the second spaceship that we see in a Secret Project book.
And I'm really questioning, is the Elantrian spaceship that we saw in Tress and this Skadrian spaceship, how much are they influencing one another? How much tech is borrowed
sure.
from one to the other? Is it an arms race where the Elantrians are like, we can do that, and the Skadrians are like, well, we can do that better, and they always need to go to Nalthus to get awakened stuff? I mean, let's learn a little bit about this spaceship that the Skadrians have. It's currently embedded in the ground to hide and protect it, but the spaceship itself has an awakened steel mine that speaks with a deep musical voice.
I'm curious if, and I think we talked about this in Tress as well, is this a generalization of the word awakened that is happening in this new globalized Cosmere, just to describe any piece of investiture technology that gains artificial intelligence? Or is this still specifically speaking only of using breath to create a thing that is able to be manipulated and or achieve some degree of sentience?
Yeah, because awakened can apply and currently does apply to things prior to them being Nightblood, whereas that is something that is, quote, woke and is fully awakened. It is conscious in a way, and we would probably say the same about the father machine as well. But something can be awakened and given directions and given commands long before it reaches a conscious or certainly an artificial intelligence.
But I think, like, point being, they wouldn't necessarily need to go to Nalthus and put breath into a steel mind to create an awakened steel mind.
Certainly,
they could remain on Scadrial and find their own way of using Scadrian investiture to create a thing that achieves something like artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if they can do it with 1,000 BEUs, if that's going to be a kind of universal amount that's required.
Yeah, I mean, like, how do you even measure that on Scadrial? You know what I mean? Like,
they don't have the same type of structure.
Right.
And their magic is normally described as metals unlocking a door to the spiritual realm.
Yeah.
Or
that's more like time-based. Like, depending on how much metal you ingest, you have a certain amount of time with access to that ability.
Yes, and normally small amounts of time. When
right.
you put it into, like, the scope of the spiritual realm, you get, like, a tiny little pinprick and opens up for a nanosecond or two, and that gives you your abilities. I don't know how they qualify that, and I would imagine if you were Nalthinians, that's the tech that you keep for yourself. You don't tell people how to do that. Maybe they can figure it out independently. And that's what I'm wondering is, are all these spaceships kind of forced to borrow from different planets, establishing a trade system that may generate peace or cooperation, at least? Or are they all versions of spaceships developed only within those planets, using all of their magic and their technology? And then we just have the language that's passed around. So an awakened steel mine doesn't actually have any breaths from Nalthus.
Right.
An Elantrian spaceship, you could say, has an awakened AI, but it's also not in any way powered by breaths. And maybe the Nalthinians do have some type of ship that is only powered by breath
yeah.
and doesn't have any other type of Scadrian tricks or Scadrian magic. But I would find it cooler if they were all little bits borrowed from here and there.
I think I would prefer to see 5 different spaceships that were all invented differently.
That would certainly be cool.
Yeah.
You would definitely have really interesting, like, how do you tackle this problem and solve it only with your own stuff?
Yeah.
But I imagine...
Which we've already seen start to happen, mm-hmm. right? Isn't that the inspiration for Nightblood, that
the shard blades from Rishar.
Went to Rishar, saw shard blades, and were like, maybe we can make something like that. So this type of information exchange has already been happening.
Yeah, and so that's why I think it would be hard to keep it from continuing to happen in a future Cosmere that's more connected.
I guess I'm not saying I don't think that would happen. What I'm saying is I don't think it's like building a car on Earth
mm-hmm.
where, you know, America puts X amount of pieces together, sends it to Mexico. Mexico puts their pieces into it, sends it to Canada. Canada puts their pieces into it, send it back to America. Like, I don't think that is happening. I don't think that the Scadrians are, like, importing Nalthian chips that do a specific thing. I do think they're probably looking or, like, sending spies, you
right.
know, to be like, go check out those people. What are they doing? That person comes back and is like, they've got this thing that looks like this and it does something like this. And then they kind of reverse engineer it with their own stuff.
On that note that you mentioned of chips, these computer chips and superconductor chips and the most advanced type of computer chips that exist today are limited to a certain number of manufacturing either regions or small areas like Taiwan. I mean, you have only a couple of places on Earth that are able to produce the top tier computer chips. And if I was one of those places like Taiwan, I would want to keep it that way. I wouldn't want another person in the Cosmere or another, you know, group of people in the Cosmere from inventing their own computer chips. I would want everyone to be coming to me, Nalthus, and to be buying and always trying to be the best at that one thing that kept people coming back.
Yeah, but that's not interesting.
Oh, it's interesting in just a different way. let's talk a little bit more, because there's so much to when it comes to space travel that we could get bogged down in like any one of these things. You haven't even asked me about relativity yet.
Yeah, now we're really about to get into it. Okay. In terms of space travel, Nomad says, quote, that was still relatively new. Well, the science was old, depending on which part of the cosmere you visited, but few had ever experimented with it until the last 100 years or so. Why take all of the effort to travel the void of space when there were easier ways to travel between planets? End quote. So we hear a little bit about the history, and that this type of space travel in a spaceship did not even really start happening until the 100 years before the Sunlit Man, which is a very short amount of time.
And we think is probably at least 100 years past
well
the
into
events
the future, it seems.
That we're currently seeing.
Yeah.
What we do know is that traveling through Shadesmar is slow, and it takes weeks or months to walk through.
And of course, there's a limited access points. There are limited places that you can get into the cognitive realm and get out of the cognitive realm. So that's quite a big restriction. Nomad does note that, quote, you could fly in the cognitive realm too, but could only get out at specific points. Faster methods that could go anywhere were just starting to be explored, but they were proportionally more difficult in their own ways. Either that, or they had some storming terrible side effects. His own experience proved that. End quote. So there are some magical other transportation methods that people are starting to look into also, and I will certainly be keeping an eye out for those types of things in future books.
I think what this can do is set a limit, because that quote is coming from the Sunlit Man, and that's Nomad's advanced knowledge. So I think that can set a limit on what we can expect after Stormlight Archive 5. I know there's been speculation around things like the Unbound Bondsmith or Unbound other versions of Radiance that are, for example, like able to create oath gates across not just Rashar, but across the Cosmere and be teleporting people across the Cosmere. Certainly, if that was developed in Stormlight Archive 5 or, you know, shortly thereafter, which is probably where we think most of the books 6 through 10 are going to be, Nomad would know about it and would be talking about it as a travel method. And they probably wouldn't have developed space travel. Like, there's a limit on what he's talking about. Going through the cognitive realm is okay to do now, and it's okay to do for hundreds of years as people are moving back and forth. But at a certain point, it becomes more beneficial to build spaceships than it is to travel through the cognitive realm. And that's kind of like, where's that line?
Yeah, of course. You've got me, my brain is all on a tangent now about the timelines of Stormlight Archive and this book, but I'm not going to go on that tangent right now. Let's talk about how you would fuel space travel. This is, of course, always the question with space travel is, how are you going to fuel it? How do you get the fuel that you need into space? How do you have enough to get back, etc., etc.? And here is a quote from the text. Quote, how much liquid oxygen you got handy? He asked. How about kerosene? Rocket fuel is not common stuff, Ox. I doubt we could put anything together in time, and I know of no sources of Zephyr Aether on this planet. Do you? End quote.
Zephyr Aether, introduced in Tress, now referenced again. Brandon has...
as rocket fuel.
Yes. We think that not only is Zephyr, otherwise known as the air Aether, going to be important for giving people oxygen when they are traveling through space, it's also going to be a main source of fuel and maybe the backbone of at least some people's space travel. Maybe there are ones that they're practicing with as well, but Zephyr certainly seems to be the main thing. And with oxygen, you have a whole bunch of fuel potential, but I think Zephyr also probably amplifies that fuel potential.
Oh, interesting.
I think that could be a secret, is that there's more potential in like a molecule of Zephyr Aether than there is just in a molecule of oxygen. In a similar way to like Sunhearts have a little bit, well, a lot more potential BEUs. I think Zephyr might be packing or punching above its weight class. Let's say it that way.
I'm curious about weight, because that's always the problem with rocket fuel here on Earth is how much it weighs.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me like a solid sand-like substance in Zephyr Aether would be heavier than something like liquid oxygen. I'm not a scientist. Maybe I'm totally wrong, but it seems like you would want the liquid oxygen more than the Zephyr Aether.
And it also depends if you're measuring in ounces or liquid ounces.
Yeah, of course.
I think you're right. I think there are still questions up there to be answered. But one of the more interesting things about Zephyr Aether is that it has a home on one of the moons around Lumar. And the most difficult thing about weight is getting out of a gravity well, getting off of Earth, in our example. Getting off any planet is where you expend the most fuel. If you don't have to go down to a planet that has a huge gravity well, and the Zephyr Aether can be siphoned directly from its moon.
You've got like a farm on the Zephyr moon.
Yes, that's just pulling it direct. Because for some of the sci-fi books or even shows that I've seen, The Expanse being one of the more like hard sci-fi in our own solar system, you know, they're pulling resources from non-planetary objects, your large space rocks that are just moving around. I would think getting something from the moon where Zephyr is would be better than like going all the way down to Lumar. And if they can just, the question I think you bring up that is accurate is like, how do you move that around? It's still a whole bunch of something of Zephyr to move around the Cosmere. And do you have like gas stations where people stop in and they pick up more Zephyr that's not Lumar? Or do you have to go to Lumar every single time you need more Zephyr?
Hopefully it's near the center of the Cosmere.
Right. Is it in a perfect crossroads? That would be so funny if it's the exact dead center of the Cosmere, Lumar with its 12 moons just going all around.
And of course, there are a lot of different technological approaches to flight. We see one of them with the Canticleites and their flying machines, which of course are not spaceships. They don't actually fly very high. But I think this is kind of an example of what I find interesting about the idea that maybe every planet will have its own kind of unique spaceship. I think it's really cool to see the different ways that different societies attack the same problem,
mm-hmm.
right? And kind of all the different solutions that can potentially exist. For the Beaconites, they have this really careful balancing of their thrusters that enables all of their ships to connect together and let their engines like all work together for their big floating city. Quote, "Too much thrust on one side would have flipped the city, but the Beaconite machinery compensated for that distribution instinctively. Zeal had mentioned when he'd been asked that the chorus helped somehow. Did they have something like a rudimentary awakened difference engine doing these calculations, fashioned by a shade?" End quote.
Big questions. I want to know
big
the answer.
Questions.
We see similar technologies on our own planet with drones, which normally are, you know, quadricopters, or they have some multiple winged or flight system that they are operating on. And if you have even one of those out of whack, it can wildly toss off the balance of such a delicate instrument. I think that's what the Beaconites are doing as well. We have a gyroscope.
But there might also be a magical awakened difference engine. So You missed the most exciting part.
Well, no, I think that what I'm trying to say is that like the drones that we see are kind of doing it with a gyroscope and a computer chip. And that's the difference engine, as I understand it. Our cars do something similar. All-wheel drive is able to shift power around to different wheels based on the traction available. And so one way or another, whether it is purely magical or some type of...
Are shades instinctively capable, or maybe not all shades, is the chorus instinctively capable of creating awakened machines?
I think the answer would have to be yes. I think the
answer
would have to be yes. They would be in the best position, maybe Spren as well, to create machines because they interact with the physical world. They are of the cognitive world. And for some reason, they're really good at understanding building engineering. Stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would think if anyone was going to be ready to build it and they could just like whip up an quote unquote awakened machine, again, not from Nalthus.
Like this could instantly take the Canticleites all the way to the top of the pecking order of the Cosmere. Like if they one day were just like, hey guys, tired of being on this planet where we're constantly running for our lives, you want to get cosmopolitan? They could immediately have awakened spaceships and any awakened machine that they desired and just go out into the Cosmere and freaking wreck people. They would have no cost of human labor or intelligence.
I'm down. I'm down. They seem like an okay sort.
Like what? I mean, you're talking about a planet or a country, you know, wanting to keep like chip building to themselves. The Canticleites would have a monopoly on instant awakened machine generation.
They would need it. They would need some aspect of their society that allowed them to rapidly catch up, because right now they're very far behind. And that's the biggest thing working against them is right. They are a primitive society
saying,
going up against spacefaring.
The second they decide they want to, their path is paved in gold.
If their shades, if the chorus can also understand things like beyond what the people of Canticle are able to.
That is what the thing is.
It's very curious. Like, are they tapping into the broader network of shades? Is there some shade that knows this?
Is it coming directly from the spiritual realm?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, yeah. So that would be my question is like...
Because basically, the Canticleites have a 3D printer that they have never invented. Mm-hmm. Like, the Canticleites did not go through the technological processes to invent the 3D printer. They just found one and were like, cool, magic thing, it makes stuff. Not because they have any knowledge of like how that works, just because it exists, seemingly.
Yeah. And so how much more, what's the limitation on its advancement? Is it an artificial intelligence, like the chorus operating as a hive mind of sorts?
Sort of, yeah.
And have they like, because they don't die or get older,
yeah,
they just like gain members to the chorus.
Yeah, like can they learn what is the actual state of their consciousness? Because they do seem to have some consciousness. They're able to speak mm-hmm. and like recognize certain things. Obviously, they're able to read schematics and build things. How far does that go? Are they capable of learning? I think is a question.
Big questions. Now let's go further. Let's hop into time dilation, relativity. Everybody's favorite topics. Good friend, Oltuck72, over on the 17th Shard, asked this, and there were many great responses from users over there. We'll put up the thread as a link so you can check it out. Do you think the thing in Canticle's core that had so much investiture, that it is turning into gravity? And there's some evidence that maybe there is time being slowed down because of the weight of investiture. Do you want to remark on this, these different kind of like elements of time dilation?
I think that that's very interesting. I think, yes, 100%, there is so much investiture in the core of the planet that it is increasing the amount of gravity / mass of the planet. And then apparently a science thing is that when that happens, time slows down, which is a fascinating piece of information to add to this Canticle puzzle.
It's definitely maybe a really important piece that like we didn't realize was even there.
Totally. And I love the points that Oltuck72 brings up. First, that Sigzel wonders how the Night Brigade gets to the planet so quickly, and the answer is they didn't get there quickly. It's just that time slowed down for him on Canticle.
There's also the question of the book, the maybe Arcanum Unbounded. Sigzel is wondering why somebody would travel with an outdated book. How did it get to Canticle in the first place? And Oltuck72 says they didn't. When he arrived, to him that book was current. Outside of Canticle, time just passed so much faster that it has become outdated.
And by he, you mean the Rasharan traveler that gets to Canticle before Nomad.
Right,
and
the original
Nomad
person.
Arrives, it's already an outdated book.
Exactly. T-Bug33 brought up a great reply as well. With all of the questions about the timeline and the time gaps that Nomad is dealing with, it would describe a lot if what Nomad was experiencing as days on Canticle, or, you know, a pretty short period of Canticle time, was warped like a speed bubble, or I suspect it would be like Marassi's
bubble. Yeah, it would be more like Marassi's bubble.
Yeah, instead of Wayne's. And so everything within it is going slower, and everything outside of the Cosmere. This would maybe also line up a bit with the Threnodites leaving the planet in the past. And then once they arrive on Canticle, Threnody of that they remember has long since changed and had many, many years go by for what has only been a generation and a half, or, you know, not that long for the Canticle people themselves. So it is possible that the Canticleites that exist are the ancestors of current day Threnodites. If anyone's still around and alive on Threnody, their great great grandparents.
Oh, like might still be alive.
Might still be alive on the other side of the world, or on the other side of the Cosmere.
Yeah.
As Canticleites.
That would be weird, especially if they went back to Threnody.
Mm-hmm.
And were, I don't know, like weird, you know, ghosts almost, or like the living dead, basically, of like my great grandmother came back to life and like brought news of a travel and technology and whatnot. Like, that would be a wild story for a population.
It would be honestly like if someone, you know, came to America looking for the Fountain of Youth and then showed up 1,000 years later and was like, I got it. And then I just chilled for like the last 1,000 years over there. And I'm just coming back to like let you know that we're good. Coming back maybe with the gift of a new renewable resource from Canticle could maybe not launch Canticle into the stratosphere of upper Cosmere planets, but could launch Threnody into that if there was a pass back.
Sure. Yeah, I don't think Canticle is going to become a vacation destination anytime soon.
But it could bring a lot back to Threnody, which has probably been seen as like, you know, encompassed by shades. But if you got your magic 3D printers that are now coming from your great, 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 you know.
Yeah.
Anything is possible.
Yeah. But yeah, really anything is possible because we don't really know anything about the timeline there anyway.
We know the Night Brigade got there quickly. And let's talk in detail about the Night Brigade.
Woo. Yeah. One of the kind of big new things from this book. Who are they? Who is the Night Brigade? Well, they are distant cousins of our Threnodites. So I'm guessing this is another one of the kind of offshoot groups that left Threnody. Because remember, there was a big group of Threnodites that originally left the planet. And then that group that left additionally splintered after their original exodus. That would be my guess, that the Night Brigade kind of seeded from one of those other splinter groups.
That makes a lot of sense. And if the time dilation theory is correct that we just described and Canticle exist in a slow bubble, then the Night Brigade are those descendants of the people that they are hunting.
Sure. And they've just advanced beyond the people of Canticle because for them, they've had more time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And maybe many generations of time. We don't know what the time scale is.
Yeah.
But it would be very funny to imagine, you know, you divide in that point in the past, and then several generations later turns into the Night Brigade who've been flying around the Cosmere, and 1.5 generations, and we have the people on Canticle.
We only hear one named person in the Night Brigade, and that is Staff Sergeant Truth Is Waiting, another excellent hyphenated pilgrim name.
We have this, quote, "The Night Brigade commands armies of the dead," he said. "They're largely a mercenary force known for their brutal efficiency. They're the only army I know that makes you keep on fighting after you've died. They are not sympathetic to the problems of local people, to put it mildly," end quote.
Scary. He also says, quote, "I know of no force more dangerous. They have been known to leave entire planets desolate. Fortunately, the Night Brigade aren't mindless pillagers. They're a precision force and will do whatever their contract, or in this case, their goal, demands. End quote. This is really the first entity group of this kind that we've seen in the Cosmere so far.
The only other glimpse at something arguably similar would be the army Men of Red and Gold that was being brought to Scadrial in the Lost Metal, but we only got a tiny glimpse of that.
Is the Army of Red and Gold the OG Night Brigade?
We never really guessed them as Threnodites. We threw out a lot of different things. You know, they were described as having some different, maybe like weapons or and it's just like we threw out a lot of guesses.
I'm saying that because Shades, when they're enraged, have red eyes.
Oh, that's a very good call. And what if you could, this is pure speculation, but what if you could do a something similar to Claude on Nalthus, where you kind of have a body and then put a shade into it, making a man of red and gold.
Man, okay, so we would have a lifeless from Nalthus.
Kind of.
Hemallergically attached to a shade from Threnody.
Yes, to make the Men of Red and Gold, which then attacked Scadrial.
I don't know if that is the Men of Red and Gold, but that's freaking terrifying.
You don't want us to just sit around and dream up nightmares.
I regret putting that out into the world at all. Like, I don't want anyone to hear that idea. So this group is described as being extremely cold-hearted and to the point where Nomad, before he leaves, is like encouraging the greater good to tell the Night Brigade everything and to just comply with everything that they say. He's kind of like, don't worry about protecting me. Like, don't try to resist. Just give in because they will torture you and be terrible.
Yeah, the only comparable thing I have in my mind for a group like this is the Mongols and kind of the description of the Mongol Empire spreading, where it was just so terrible. And they often would like send someone ahead of the horde and just be like, hey, by the way, the Mongols are coming. You should just give up now and give us all your stuff. And if you don't, it's going to be very bad for you. And a lot of people just said, yeah, we do give up to the Mongol horde. And a lot of people said no. And then very bad things happened to them, much like the Night Brigade.
Of course, the Mongols were just conquering. In this case, it does sound like the Night Brigade has some restraint where they only exercise those types of powers in the restrictions of their contract or whatever their goal is. They're not sort of indiscriminately going around destroying planets, but if someone's going to pay them for it, then they'll do it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of always been an aspect of wars. You have these like mercenary groups or just kind of like hardened men, normally who fought in like the last war and then don't have anything to do and are, you know, going to get in a group of 50 to 100 people. And if you have 50 to 100 of well outfitted or, you know, advanced tech people, you don't need a lot more to cause a lot of havoc in the direct type of way. You maybe can't hold land or conquer a planet, but you can lay waste to a section or hunt a Dawn Shard holder. Because let's go to the description of like, what's the whole purpose of this hunt?
Well, because it sounds like they have some specific abilities at their disposal. Quote, he'd learned soon that with their twisted arts, they could kill him and fashion a spike from his soul that would lead them to the person he had given the Dawn Shard. To them, Nomad was a crucial link in a very important chain, and he was far more useful dead than alive, end quote.
Yeah, a soul spike that points in the direction like a compass. Did you ever do that like a little science experiment when you get a small needle or whatnot, and then you put it on a cork, and the cork goes in water, and then you magnetize the needle with some friction, and all of a sudden the cork like spins around to give you a basic compass?
I don't recall that one, but I am familiar with the way a compass works.
And this to me sounds like a soul compass that is pointing you to the thing that you want, in this case, the Dawn Shard.
I mean, yeah, it seems to have some kind of ability to track connection, to track a specific connection, and then also some ability to navigate or like have a sense of space. to take you to that person. Maybe there is like multiple layers of things happening there. Like perhaps the soul spike is able to track connection, and then they kind of plug that spike into a different machine that will follow the thread of connection to the person. But that is very advanced and quite interesting that these Threnodites are using Skadrian methods in hemallergy.
The Admiral was asked about during Brandon's spoiler stream for The Sunlit Man, and the question was, is the Admiral someone that we've seen before or exist in?
Or related to someone we know.
Excellent. And Brandon said that the Admiral will be the protagonist of the Night Brigade book that he has planned, we'll say, for who knows when, but certainly someone that we have the potential to see again. But he did not in any way say that it was related to an existing character.
Correct. The Admiral seems quite fearsome, and she has a continuity chain, which is described as a silver whip-like weapon that's rolled up and kind of hanging from her hip. This, of course, is making me think of a chain that Raboniel has,
yes,
that she gets from Mraes. Is this the same thing? What are its properties? It seems like this is going to become very important, potentially very soon.
But it also, to me, strikes a similar tone to another warrior woman, Azure / Vivenna, in the way that she uses normally fabric with her sword and like has fabric rolled up next and then like throws it out with an awakened command. And I'm wondering, you got to like train with the best. You know, Vasher would teach you all the different fighting styles. I would think if you're going to be an elite mercenary force, you've also maybe adopted some of the different fighting techniques from around the Cosmere. We've never seen that chain be used in a weapon fashion, but this is weapon-esque.
I don't know if it's a weapon in that way. I think it's more of a spell if we're in Baldur's Gate. Like, I think continuity chain is a spell slot.
Okay.
Not Thorn a whip. Weapon. Yeah, it's more of a thorn whip type thing.
Interesting. Cantrip. That's just for all the nerds out there.
We've lost half the population. And then around the Admiral, she is surrounded by extra creepy shades. Like, you thought shades were creepy. Here is the description of the Night Brigade shades. Quote, as he left, two shades with glowing red eyes bearing the uniforms they'd been wearing when they died joined him from the corners of the room. The Admiral needed no vocal command for them, and their movement meant she obviously wanted to be alone. Not even accompanied by the dead, end quote.
Really terrifying. Lot to ask about the Night Brigade, their powers, their role in the Cosmere. But it does harken back to what I said many hours ago, which is that it seems like there was a reason everybody had to be afraid in the Cosmere. That these like mercenary groups from Skadriel or from Threnody, they like felt a need to exist. And I'm wondering if that's all one event or if it's a series of things that will play out over many books and many stories. But I right now kind of see badness coming out from Stormlight Archive 5, and maybe like 6 through 10 is getting a hold on some of that and like bringing it back to Rashar for like a final showdown type of thing. But sends out like the bad vibes. A wave of odium badness goes out into the Cosmere, and everybody then responds with like, we're going to be a brutal military force, or we're going to be dispassionate scientists who are creating a brutal military force for the protection of Skadriel. Really a lot to think about. Let's end with everyone's favorite storyteller and a story to be told. This is Hoid. Hoid time.
We only see Hoid a little bit in this book when Ox makes a capital C connection between Nomad and Hoid. And Hoid has this connection-fueled communication with Nomad that reminds me a lot of the hologram communications that we see in many a sci-fi world.
Help me, Obi-Hoid Kenobi. You're my only hope. Although, never mind. Nomad didn't want to talk to him.
No, he did not.
This was more like Ox. Ox is Princess Leia in
Ox
this
was
situation.
Like, I think you should call home. And he was like, I don't want to talk to my dad. He was like, but I think that you need to.
You probably need to, buddy. And he did.
And this was a cool conversation, actually. Mm-hmm. First, I want to talk just a little bit about this process of capital C connection communication, which is something we've not seen before. From a sensory perspective, Nomad says, quote, then he felt something, a tugging on his insides, a kind of strange warmth, end quote. And then when Hoid appears, it's described as, quote, he glowed softly, visible even in the darkness, and his substance rippled at the rain's interference like he was a reflection on a puddle. This was an illusion, end quote.
I think this connection is also exactly what the Night Brigade are hunting. They are able instinctively or, you know, with encouragement from Ox, but the Night Brigade should seemingly also be able to do that, maybe one direction or the other. They're hoping to go not towards Hoid, but towards whoever Nomad gave the Dawn Shard. So they're looking to go down the chain, where backwards would be Hoid.
Yeah. And this is a little bit similar to the communication that we see happening with Seons in Elantris, where the cognitive entity, Seon or Spren, is able to generate an image, a kind of real-time image of the person that someone is communicating with. So I think that this is also not just a product of capital C connection, but that it requires the cognitive entity in order to communicate in this way.
That's interesting. It would imply that the cognitive entity, you mean Ox, right?
Yeah.
Is somehow connected to Hoid as well.
Well, I think the cognitive entity is operating like the electricity and kind of the machinery that is just going down the line.
Mm-hmm.
It's just following the power line to Hoid and then doing whatever process it needs to do to create an image of Hoid in real time.
Right.
Yeah.
So it has that connection back to Hoid that Ox can like move down like a power line.
Like, because Ox is part of Nomad's web, spirit web, Ox is able to travel down all of the pathways of the web.
Okay.
Basically.
I am wondering if it is an indicator of when Ox was added to the system. If the Dawn Shard was given while Ox was bonded, would that be different than if the Dawn Shard was given and then Ox bonded Nomad later?
No.
Interesting. These are the fun thoughts that I have. Let's get some more Hoid. I'm not done with Hoid, even though there was much time with Hoid.
Because this was basically the only time that, one, Hoid has been earnest, and two, that we've heard anything at all about Hoid's like actual past and life in a concrete way. He's made some sort of oblique comments in the past about certain things that are driving him, about people that he's loved, etc., or, you know, the history of his name, but nothing that we could really hold on to. And in The Sunlit Man, we finally get a single story about Hoid's past.
Quote, I was that boy, Wit said from behind, when I was young, on Yolen, before this all began, before God died and world started ending. I was that boy. I can remember sitting on a rooftop, looking up and wondering what the stars were. I assumed I'd never know. The town philosophers had talked themselves hoarse arguing the matter, as was often their way. End quote.
It's so endearing to think about Hoid as a boy.
Yeah, and just kind of like the journey that he has been on.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of questioned, you know, is Hoid himself anymore after all this time? Is he suffering in the same way that the heralds show suffering, or other long-lived entities show suffering? Has he avoided that? How has he avoided it? All these questions that kind of swirl around what is Hoid,
mm-hmm,
are grounded in the fact that he was a mortal, a child who had dreams and lived in a world where his people didn't understand any more than the Canticle people really understand. Right. Just like what was in front of them, what was their day to day. And from that, so much would happen.
And I think I've never really considered what it would, or like how it would affect someone like Hoid, who lives through a cataclysmic event like we can't even imagine. As he said, when God died and worlds start ending, and to be fully like present and aware and witnessing it, and yet not fully a participant because he did not become a vessel. And the way that that kind of event would fundamentally shape a person, I don't think I've really considered before. Like, we talk a lot and sort of throw around the idea that Hoid was president of the Shattering. Hoid was president of the Shattering. He knew about it, blah, blah, blah. But I've never thought about, like, the emotional component and the real impact that that would have. And so this really added a layer to Hoid's character for me.
That's great. I think that the only comparable moment that we have on display is that first 30 to 40 minutes of Endgame, after the snap, after everybody's lost.
Avengers Endgame, to clarify.
Thank you very much. But after the snap and after the Avengers have lost, you get these glimpses into everybody's life and how they're trying to deal with that utter destruction of half of all beings in the universe, certainly worlds ending and trying to put together the pieces. I think that in moments, maybe not every moment, but in moments, Hoid is Steve Rogers-esque. He's sitting at the trauma recovery group, you know, trying to talk to the other vessels, maybe at some points. Or
is he? I don't know. I feel like he's running away from all of it, just like, I'm fine. I'm fine.
No, and I think that happened too. That happened, you know, with other characters in the Marvel world. They try to abandon, they try to go do their own thing, and then they get dragged back in, but they thought it was over. All that jazz. You have different responses to the ultimate trauma. And Hoid is one of those responses, one of those responding individuals. And we are witnessing his growth and evolution, his change.
And obviously his entire trajectory is based on that event. Everything that he has done from then on has been completely shaped and defined by that event, which is in some ways a story about a group of people, you know, climbing their way up to God, like finding a path to God, which we've seen similar stories throughout the Cosmere. And there is another story somewhat similar to that dropped in The Sunlit Man. We hear an Azish story told by Nomad about the Alethi. And this story describes the Alethi as these bloodthirsty giants who come to the Azish at least once a generation after generation to try to conquer and destroy them. And they're described as, quote, a horde of death and destruction that ate the land, consumed villages like insects swarming the crops, ripping, smashing, end quote.
To make it extra devastating, Nomad says, quote, they call themselves the Alethi, but we knew them as the Tagarut, the breakers, it means, those who leave only death, end quote.
Which is a pretty harsh version of the history of the Alethi and the Alethi that we've seen. We've always heard them described as being really warlike, but this perspective from another culture on that time in Alethi history is quite illuminating.
Yeah, and I called out the Mongols earlier. Brandon has said that the Alethi do match the Mongols, not on horseback or that type of conquest, but Genghis Khan is a Dalinar inspiration or vibes of a sort. And in the story that Nomad is telling, the Alethi eventually change tactics. They decide that the sun shone so bright that it must be filled with treasure, and they wanted to go up to the sun and conquer whoever lived there and take the treasure for their own, kind of turning their attention from the mortal beings that they had destroyed and facing them upwards to God.
So they climb to the top of the tallest mountain, they build a scaffold, and they climb all the way up to the sun, only to be blinded by the treasure and incapable of bringing it back. And this story is a way of explaining why the light eyes, Alethi, have pale eyes. Quote, "But the sunlight was too bright. The riches of the vault of the Almighty itself glowed with an intense heat. The Tagarut could not carry the gemstones they found, for they shone so bright as to destroy a man. The proud giants, the terrible warriors, they were forced to flee, beaten not by spears or shields, but by the very treasure they sought to claim."
From that day, it was said that their eyes had been bleached by the intense light, like clay cooked too long. Instead of normal dark browns, many Alethi have watery blue or other light eyes. The brilliance of the heavens, where Yazir himself sits upon his throne, had destroyed their ability to see as common people do. Though they now saw the world washed out, the gleam of treasure also faded because of this. End quote.
Really cool story. Very cool to hear this different perspective. And I find this little parable sort of interesting. Obviously, for a real world comparison, it has some similarities to the story of the Tower of Babel, also of Icarus getting too close to the sun.
And then for some comps in the Cosmere, we have stories like The Girl Who Looked Up or even Wandersail, where not so much did the beings go to kill God, but to confront their God, their king, and show up realizing
and they do have to go up into a tower
exactly, yeah. Only to realize that their God was not there and the cause of their problems was themselves.
Yeah,
that's a twist
right
on the story.
But I think to The Girl Who Looked Up, this continual idea that is being put forward on Rishar that there was some type of climb to the top to bring light back, there seems to be a seed of truth in that idea, and I'm curious to see if we get the real story of that.
Yeah, because from a Rasharan perspective, what is the light and what is the truth that is being brought? Is the light only power or treasure, as Nomad says from the story? Is that the magic, the unbonded ashen magic that caused their planet's destruction, kind of blinded or destroyed their one planet, leading to, or is it something that happened on Rishar? Is it, you know, reaching to the Spren, forming the Os and the bonds that are going to lead to the desolations and that conflict? I love these subtle ways of incorporating stories within the stories and giving us these connections. There's so much more. The Sunlit Man could be picked apart in much more detail. And I think we are going to return to each of the secret projects and try to create more theories, all pointing us back, hopefully, to Stormlight Archive for the release later this year.
We'll see.
But this has been another fantastic book club. Brooke, do you have any closing thoughts before we say farewell?
Thanks for being here with us, reading along and sharing all of your thoughts about these incredible books. This is our last episode in our formal Secret Project series. It's been a great year of Sanderson, and we just really appreciate y'all being here.
Can you take us away?
Until next time, life before death,
strength before weakness,
journey before destination.